This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the massive installation of ultra-conservative justices, not only to the Supreme Court, but judges in the circuit courts across the nation.
Founding fathers made a big mistake appointing these guys for life, and we're going to have to live with it.
Is the United States headed toward fascism?
We don't have fascism here, obviously. If we did, we wouldn't be broadcasting this radio show. You wouldn't be listening to it. You'd probably be in a lot worse position than you are now. But we're taking steps in that direction. And recognizing that is our most immediate responsibility.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, last week we had the midterm elections. I know you don't have much faith in the Democratic Party, but what did you think about the results and the Democrats taking back the House?
Blue wave that was supposed to wash over the country turned out to be pretty much of a hype.
A splash,
although,
perhaps.
Although the Democrats did prevail in a number of congressional races and, of course, now have the majority in the House. Whether this means much, we'll have to see. The Democrats are not a coherent force, nor necessarily a progressive force. The last thing they did before Congress broke its session was the Democrats promised Trump that he could have all 17 of his judicial nominations put through as long as they got an immediate recess so they could go home and campaign. So they guaranteed us 17 more reactionary judges. You know, I haven't voted Democratic since 1964, when I very reluctantly voted for Lyndon Johnson because he promised that he wouldn't escalate the war in Vietnam, which, of course, is what he did. I vote for independent candidates, socialist candidates. I voted for the Green Party this time. I did vote for Delgado, though, up in the Catskills, where I sometimes live. He ran in Ulster County. He was opposed by this really detestable figure named Robert Faso. And Faso had a lot of financial support and ran an ad accusing Delgado. It was just an outright racist ad because it accused him of being a rapper with all the connotations of what a rapper is. Well, Delgado actually went to Harvard Law School and studied at Oxford, but they were trying to undercut him by pointing out that he was a black menace to the people that live in the Catskills. And I thought for that reason alone, I'd get behind him. And it turns out that I'm in District 3 of Rochester Township, and Delgado won by one vote in District 3. So I feel like driving up to Ulster County yesterday and voting served a purpose. I put him over the top in District 3.
Well, I was watching late night to see the results of Texas. Beto O'Rourke challenging Ted Cruz. And while I was disappointed that Beto lost, the margin, at least based on the numbers that came out the day after, it was a very close race, which for Texas is, for we progressives or radicals, heartening. And Beto had some high-profile support from entertainers like Beyoncé, Kira Sedgwick, John Goodman, and others. So that was, I think, a slow yet positive move forward.
Yeah, well,
in a red state.
It's hard to beat an incumbent.
Yeah.
Cruz is particularly obnoxious.
I know.
It's regrettable that the guy is going to be with us for another 6 years.
Yeah.
The other major races that the Democrats were hoping to win were Stacey Adams in Georgia for governor.
Right.
She went down.
Yeah.
Gillum in Florida. Another African-American, he went down. So it was not a particularly wonderful day for the Democratic Party. Ask me what I think they should have done.
No, I want to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let's just focus for a moment on the positive fact that the Democrats have the House. That gives them subpoena power. I know you don't think that means much.
Well, it would if they'd use it. let's see. They, you know, they can go after Trump. They can go after his financial records. They can go after his anti-democratic attacks. Let's see what they do. I'm not encouraged. And the reason I'm not is the reason that Ralph Nader spoke about last night when he was on Amy Goodman's show. Both parties are dialing for the same dollars, and they don't want to rock the boat. And I'm not sure the Democrats, now that they've got the majority in Congress, are going to rock the boat. Politics has the advantage over religion. You can actually see how it works out.
Just one other positive, Michael. The number of women projected when we are speaking to win seats in the House is a huge victory. There's a projected 98 women to win the House races, with 33 newly elected women to the House. And that's also a sign of the times, especially with what happened with the Kavanaugh hearings, that people are more willing to support female candidates than in the past.
Yeah, I think that's terrific. What they do with their vote is something, again, we'll have to see.
Right.
But I think overall, the Democrats would have had a much stronger showing had they had an aggressive social democratic platform. If they would have been for free health care for everybody, education for everybody, if they would have gone after the military budget, if they would have gone after Trump's recklessness in canceling the intermediary nuclear treaty with Russia, if they would have pointed out that the United States has been at war for the last 17 years, that half of the money that we have for government spending goes to war. If they would have taken an aggressive stance towards bettering the life of all these, you know, half of the country are poor or near poor. If they would have taken an aggressive stance in reaching out to these people and coming up with programs that would better their lives, they would have had an impact. But they don't want to do that. And the reason they don't want to do that is that we have really one party in this country, and it's the party of big corporate business. And they don't want to spend money doing those kinds of things, so they don't talk about them.
All right. I don't want us to end on such a dismal note, so I'd like to point out, Michael, that the turnout for a midterm election in a non-presidential year was higher than ever. Apparently, about 115 million ballots were cast this year, and that's compared to 83 million votes cast in 2014 and 91 million in 2010. Pretty impressive.
I think so. People were so disgusted when Trump ran for president that most people didn't vote. And I think people felt now like they really have to step up and do what they can. I think they were doing battle with a blunted instrument, that
yes,
is the Democratic Party. But
we had many problems in the voter booths across the nation.
Yeah. Here in New York, people stand in line for 2 hours in the rain. That's intentional. The Republicans know that most people are not Republicans, and if they can suppress the vote, they're in a better shape, and that's what they intentionally did.
Okay, so just to wrap this up, I think some of us who are harsh critics of Trump are pleased, at least, that the Democrats, despite their flaws and shortcomings, have taken over the House, because it's a little fairer in the big picture. It does remain to be seen what the Democrats will do with that victory. But we had record turnout, and I think if this teaches people about the power of voting, that's a good thing. And then hopefully we'll get an alternate party.
Heidi, from your mouth to God's ears.
In less than 2 years, Donald Trump has installed not one, but two right-wing justices on the Supreme Court, ensuring a conservative majority for decades to come. Republican congressional leadership appropriated a high court appointment from Barack Obama and appointed Neil Gorsuch. Gorsuch has cast the deciding vote in 14 cases that hurt workers, consumers, voters, immigrants, and reproductive rights, while upholding abuses of government authority. Notably, he cast the deciding vote to uphold Trump's Muslim travel ban in the case Trump v. Hawaii. Republicans then pushed through the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh, who lied under oath and displayed conduct unbecoming of a justice. Justice Gorsuch has upheld the views of conservative Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation backers. Kavanaugh will likely do the same. The public is less aware, however, of Trump's systematic appointment of 29 right-wing judges on the federal circuit courts of appeals. And he hopes to appoint even more by year-end. These circuit court appointees have handed down regressive decisions, favoring the interests of the rich and upholding unlimited spending in politics. Judges who sit on the circuit courts wield enormous power because most cases are resolved at that level. Seventh Circuit Judge Amy Coney Barrett, for example, voted in one case to allow a corporation to racially segregate its workplace. She also rejected the asylum claim of an immigrant who alleged he was tortured without even considering the merits of the case. And in the Sixth Circuit, Judge Amul Thapar voted to allow public officials to lead Christian-only prayers at public Board of Commissioner meetings. These decisions are just the tip of the iceberg. Joining us to talk about this dramatic swing to the right on the nation's highest courts is law professor and author Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a constitutional rights expert and is a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She is a frequent legal commentator in print and in the electronic media. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi. It's good to be here.
Before we talk about judges, a rather depressing subject, what did you think of last week's election turnout?
Well, I was delighted that the Democrats took back the House of Representatives because that will stop any attempt at legislation that would repeal Obamacare, imperil Social Security, Medicare, etc. And I thought it was a good margin. It was not an unusual margin of victory, but nevertheless, that enables the Democrats in the House, who are now controlling the House of Representatives, to hold hearings and even impeach Trump if they want. Now, impeachment is just it's like bringing a complaint or an indictment. It takes 51% of the House of Representatives. They easily could do that, and it would certainly publicize a lot of his lawbreaking. Then it goes to the Senate, and they have to decide by two-thirds to remove him in a trial, and that wouldn't happen. Nevertheless, there might be political reasons to mount impeachment, but they could hold hearings on a number of things. They could get a hold of Trump's tax returns. They could see how he has been profiting from the presidency. And most importantly, they can stop any kind of progressive legislation. Now, that also will mean there will be deadlocks. They may shut down the government again. And, of course, the Senate is a different story. At this point, it's certainly the Senate is still in Republican hands, and that means, and this is, of course, germane to our discussion, that means that Trump can continue to get his judicial appointments approved, confirmed by the Senate. And since there's a possibility that he could have even two more Supreme Court appointments, because both Ginsburg and Breyer are in their 80s, that is a very frightening thought. And he can continue to fill the courts, the lower courts, the appellate courts, and the federal district courts with right-wing conservative judges and justices.
Thank you for that. And that leads right into our first question. We would like to start by reminding our audience really of the importance of these federal circuit courts. What weight do judges at that level wield?
Well, they wield tremendous weight, Heidi. Those are the federal circuit courts of appeals, and since most cases are decided at that level, that's extremely significant. There are fewer than 100 cases per year that actually get decided by the Supreme Court, and that means the bulk of them are decided in the federal circuits. That is the law of the land. So they are extremely important, and they're also, of course, lifetime appointments, which means that they will be there for years to come.
This is a difficult question, but in the grand scheme of things, do you think we should be more concerned about the composition of the High Court, the Supreme Court, or of these other courts?
Well, you know, most public attention focuses on the Supreme Court, and that is certainly the highest court in the land, the makes the law of the land. People are now, I think, after the Kavanaugh hearings, much more aware of what the Supreme Court does. I think that most people in this country would be hard-pressed to even recognize many of the justices on the Supreme Court, except, of course, RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has become something of an icon. So the Supreme Court is extremely important, and Trump is appointing young people who will be on the court for decades, maybe 3 or 4 decades. Very, very important. The Supreme Court has the last word on many of the most important issues facing us. But since, as I said before, most cases are decided at the Circuit Court of Appeals level, that is also an incredibly important level of courts. And so I think it would be difficult to say that the Supreme Court is more important than the circuit courts. I think that most people would say that, but I think ultimately in terms of the number of cases decided and the issues decided, I would be hard-pressed to choose between them in terms of importance.
How does Trump compare to other presidents' appointments of judges, both in speed and number, and how has he been able to do this?
Trump has had confirmed 2 justices to the Supreme Court and 29 judges on the circuit courts of appeals. And in 2016, Trump was elected with a very high number of vacancies waiting to be filled. Obama had confirmed only 20 judges, federal judges, in his first 2 years when the Democrats had control of the Senate. Trump has already, in his first 2 years, had 84 federal judges confirmed. And Mitch McConnell, the GOP leader, used the filibuster to block 82 of Obama's judicial nominees in the second term. And before Obama, Senate leaders in both parties throughout U.S. history had blocked a total of 86 nominations with the filibuster. So you can see that McConnell blocked 82 of the Obama judges, whereas in all of history, they had only blocked 86. And that's what caused Harry Reid, who was the Democratic leader, to end the filibuster on judges except for the Supreme Court. And then McConnell followed suit for the U.S. Supreme Court in order to seat Trump's 2 nominees to the Supreme Court with many fewer than 60 votes. With the filibuster, you would need 60 votes to confirm a judicial appointment or a judicial nominee. Gorsuch was confirmed with only 54 votes out of 100, and Kavanaugh with 50 votes.
How much influence does the Federalist Society wield in terms of these appointments? Where did it come from, and how did it become so powerful?
Well, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, both radical right-wing organizations, prepared a list or 2 or 3 for Trump, and Trump has picked his judicial nominees straight off that list. So you can see it's extremely influential, and the Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation screen judges, and many of them are circuit court judges who are possibilities for the Supreme Court, and then also federal district court judges, that's the trial level in the federal court, for possible elevation to the circuit courts of appeals. And so they have screened them to make sure that they possess the sufficient right-wing bona fides. Michael Avery and Danielle McLaughlin wrote a fascinating book called The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. And they say that every single federal judge appointed by both Presidents Bush was either a member or approved by members of the Federalist Society, including 4 Supreme Court justices, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. And this is the analysis in this book, which I highly recommend. The Federalist Society persuaded the competing factions of the modern conservative movement to put aside their ideological differences and come together around a doctrine called originalism. originalism means that they try to define what the founders intended at the time and what the public thought at the time that the Constitution was written. And they're also textualists, which means that they look at the text. And if it's not in the text of the Constitution or the statute, then they theoretically rule against it, although they're constantly embellishing the text in reality. But this was really a conservative counter-revolution against the liberal landmarks of the Warren Court. Chief Justice Earl Warren in the 50s and 60s was a conservative. He was a Republican appointee by Eisenhower, and yet he and Brennan, who was really kind of the brains behind the Warren Court, reacted to the civil rights movement, inequality between rich and poor, between whites and non-whites, and the Vietnam War, and rose to the occasion and decided some of the most significant Supreme Court decisions we've ever had. Now, the founding document of the Federalist Society was a report issued in 1988 by Ed Meese, who was the Attorney General in the Reagan administration, and that report described 15 areas of potential conflict on the Supreme Court, including abortion, gay rights, affirmative action, states' rights, and it outlined a strategy for narrowing the right to reproductive choice. It stressed the need for selecting the right judges, and Kavanaugh, who is now, of course, as we know, on the Supreme Court, had a lot to do with George W. Bush's judicial nominees when he worked in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration. And according to Kavanaugh, he said that George W. Bush devoted more attention to the issue of judges than any other president. So that's how we got to where we are.
Marjorie, I want to let our listeners know now and at the end of the show about your wonderful website. It's MarjorieCohn.com, and listeners can read your extensive writings, see what books you've written, which are many, and really catch up with Constitutional Law 101. I want to talk now about some of the cases that have happened in the last 2 years. New judges in the federal courts have handed down some pretty regressive decisions. Can you mention one or two that stand out to you as particularly unconstitutional?
Well, the 11th Circuit judges Kevin Newsom and Lisa Branch issued a ruling against LGBT equality in employment. And Newsom also cast the deciding vote to throw out a claim of unconstitutional and inhumane conditions of confinement in prisons, including inmates being forced to walk barefoot on floors with urine, semen, and vomit. And Fifth Circuit Judge James Ho cast the deciding vote to erect hurdles to the right to abortion, and he strongly criticized Roe v. Wade in a separate concurrence. There was a Fifth Circuit judge who suspended an injunction and allowed the unconstitutional jailing of poor people in Texas to continue. 11th Circuit Judge Kevin Newsom filed a concurrence to reconsider the precedent of the 11th Circuit that a large cross maintained by the city on public property violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, which prohibits the government from making any law respecting an establishment of religion. Fifth Circuit judges James Ho, Don Willett, Kyle Duncan, and Kurt Engelhardt all voted in dissent to reconsider a decision upholding a federal gun control law, and Third Circuit Judge Stefanos Bibas joined a dissent from a ruling that protected transgender students against right-wing attacks.
Let's turn our attention to the Supreme Court for a moment, Marjorie. We've seen how Gorsuch has come down siding with the other four conservative judges to overrule the longstanding precedents in the Janus versus AFSCME, those are the government workers, that protected the right of public sector employees to participate in effective collective bargaining. What was your reaction when that decision came down?
It was outrageous. It was a real blow to the labor movement. It was not unexpected, but Gorsuch, who, as many people know, filled a seat that Obama had the right to fill. He had nominated Merrick Garland, and yet McConnell, for a year, refused to hold hearings on Merrick Garland, and so ultimately that vacancy was filled by Trump, and he nominated Neil Gorsuch. And Neil Gorsuch, he has cast the deciding vote in 14 cases that hurt workers, consumers, voters, immigrants, reproductive rights, and upheld abuses of government authority. He voted that 100,000 service advisors employed by auto dealerships are not entitled to overtime pay under federal law. He voted to uphold Ohio's voter purge system, which was triggered by people who don't vote. And as a result, more than 1 million voters were erased from the voting rolls. He voted to uphold Texas's redistricting schemes, which a lower court had unanimously said had been established with the intent to discriminate against people of color. And Gorsuch also joined Thomas in a concurrence in that case, suggesting that the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits discriminatory practices, shouldn't apply to redistricting decisions. He voted to uphold Trump's infamous Muslim ban. He voted that detained immigrants aren't entitled to bond hearings under federal immigration law, and as a result, thousands of people could be incarcerated for months or even years with no possibility of bail. He voted to deny Arkansas prisoners a stay of execution by a method likely to cause excruciating pain. The state of Arkansas was rushing to execute 8 people in 11 days to use up their store of the painful drug before its expiration date. And Gorsuch wrote the decision which limited the amount of damages prisoners could recover for severe abuse by prison officials. So he is not disappointing the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation and Trump and the right-wingers who installed him on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, he's truly a nightmare. I have a couple of fun facts. You know, of course, that he went to the same high school with Kavanaugh, Georgetown Prep.
Yes.
And when he was there as a freshman, he founded an organization called Fascism Forever and kept that organization going for all 4 years he was there. Fascism is not a friend of working people, and his decisions haven't been either.
Oh, it's so outrageous. It's hard to find words.
Well, on another topic that's hard to find words, we could really devote a whole show to what I thought was the decidedly unjudicial conduct of Kavanaugh. He joined the High Court on October 9th, but hasn't yet ruled on a case. Your predictions, will he be just like Gorsuch?
He will, and it's possible he might even be worse, if that's possible, on voting rights. And, of course, we've just come off of this election where I think it would have been a much larger margin that the Democrats would have enjoyed in the House and maybe even in the Senate if it wasn't for the redistricting, the gerrymandering, the cheating that went on. I mean, voting rights are really key, and we all know that, and there was tremendous voter turnout for that reason. But Kavanaugh has decided only one voting rights case. In South Carolina, he wrote an opinion for a 3-judge panel that upheld a voter ID law. The Obama Justice Department had opposed the law, finding that it violated the Voting Rights Act because it could disenfranchise tens of thousands of non-white voters who were less likely than whites to have identification. And yet he ignored all of that evidence and voted to uphold that voter ID act. And he also joined a separate, actually he had declined to join a separate concurrence by the two other judges on the panel that reaffirmed the vital function of the Voting Rights Act. So I fear what he might do to voting rights. He has not cast any vote yet. There was an age discrimination case that was decided by the Supreme Court, but Kavanaugh didn't participate, and it unanimously ruled in favor of the employees. There's an immigrants' rights case in which Kavanaugh participated in the oral argument, whether the government can detain immigrants for the duration of their deportation proceedings without a hearing just because they have past criminal records, even if they've served their time. And at oral argument, it was pretty clear that Kavanaugh was siding with the government and would deny due process to these immigrants. Ironically, it was Kavanaugh who was whining about not having due process when he was accused of sexual assault by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And given his record on immigrants' rights, and what he said during oral argument, I don't think there's much of a doubt how he's going to rule in that case. In the Garza versus Hargan case, when he was on the Court of Appeals, Kavanaugh wrote a dissent and accused the majority of creating, quote, a new right for unlawful immigrant minors in U.S. government detention to obtain immediate abortion on demand, unquote. And he would have imposed an even longer waiting period on a 17-year-old undocumented immigrant who had fulfilled all the state requirements. There are other decisions that may come before the Supreme Court. There's one on the Endangered Species Act, and I won't get into the details of it, but it has to do with when courts should defer to the rulings of government agencies. And he opposes the Chevron deference doctrine, and that doctrine says that when a law is ambiguous, courts must defer to an agency's reasonable construction of the statute. And that becomes really important because using that Chevron deference, courts have deferred to agency interpretations that upheld essential protections, including deferring to the National Labor Relations Board determination that certain employees are entitled to the protection of the National Labor Relations Act. The Environmental Protection Agency's rule requiring states to reduce emissions from power plants and the Department of Labor's interpretation of parts of the Black Lung Benefits Act that make it easier for coal miners afflicted with black lung disease to receive compensation. There are also possible additional cases that may come before the Supreme Court on gerrymandering, church-state separation, employment discrimination against gay and transgendered people. And his record, unfortunately, in those areas is not good news for the rights of poor people, working people, voters, LGBTQ, voter rights, well, I already said voter rights, church-state separation, etc. So I think that we can look forward to three or four decades of Kavanaugh ruling to strip many people of their rights as a result of Trump's nomination.
I would add another category to that, and that's the rights of people who have been tortured. In one of those cases, the Kaki case, is coming up before the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh was part of the Bush legal team, and it didn't come out because the Republicans wouldn't allow it. But papers, I think, would have shown that Kavanaugh was part of the team that developed a strategy of saying that torture was not torture. And their formulation was that unless someone suffers pain of losing a bodily organ, that's not torture. And that's how they got around it. And I think that Kavanaugh was part of that. So I fear what's going to happen when those cases come up. Do you think that lawyers will change their filing strategies to avoid federal judges? We had that discussion on the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights. What would you have said during that discussion?
There are tactical decisions, strategic decisions that lawyers make about where to file their cases and whether to appeal to the Supreme Court when they lose at the circuit court level. And progressive attorneys are working on developing strategies to circumvent the increasingly disastrous judges taking the federal bench. For example, environmental groups are coordinating with each other about whether to file cases in the Supreme Court, and many lawyers are filing cases in state rather than federal court where their clients will get a fairer shot. So the answer is yes. That certainly will change the strategy of many progressive attorneys, including, well, Center for Constitutional Rights, of course.
Marjorie, your website, marjoriecohn.com, is a wealth of information for listeners. You have given us really a sobering overview of where we are legally in this country. We thank you for your insights and analysis and hope to have you on again.
Thanks so much, Heidi and Michael. I appreciate it and would love to come back.
Great. Take care.
Good to talk with you, Margie. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Years ago, American socialist and famed novelist Jack London, in his book The Iron Heel, anticipated what we are seeing developing in the USA today. He wrote, "There is a shadow of something colossal and menacing that even now is beginning to fall across the land. Call it the shadow of an oligarchy, if you will. It is the nearest I dare approximate it. What its nature may be, I refuse to imagine, but what I wanted to say was this: you are in a perilous position." With our experience with fascism in the 20th century in Germany and Italy, and with what we see developing in the United States today, we can clearly imagine what American fascism would look like. Socialism would be illegal and its proponents imprisoned. Labor unions would be totally eliminated as an organization for those without property. Quality public education would be further reduced. The independence of public universities would be totally undermined. Billions of dollars would continually be devoted to slick propaganda. Much of traditional government functions, with the exception of the police and the armed forces, would be privatized. The media and the internet would be put under direct government control. Human-caused catastrophic climate change would not be addressed, as anti-scientific thinking and anti-intellectualism would be encouraged in a fact-free culture. Minorities, blacks, Muslim, Jews, Mexicans, LGBTQ people would be scapegoated for society's ills. Women would be denied control over their bodies. Church and state would no longer be separated, and the rule of law would be cast aside. Fascism just doesn't descend on us all at once like the falling of a dark curtain. It creeps in. It has been creeping in over the last 40 years of neoliberalism and with the rise of the ultra-right who have taken over the Republican Party. All this was topped off 2 years ago with the election of Trump. In the last 2 weeks, it's gotten even worse. 2 black people were assassinated in Kentucky. 11 Jews were slaughtered inside their Pittsburgh synagogue. Trump canceled a nuclear non-proliferation pact with Russia. He declared himself a nationalist, really a white nationalist, and then sent 14,000 troops to the Mexican border to prevent desperate, mostly women and children walking north from Honduras from claiming their lawful right to asylum. And then he threatened to cancel birthright citizenship, a right guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to our Constitution. We know what fascism looks like. We have identified it, but what do we do about it? What do we do to fight it? Here to speak with us today is Barry Shepherd. He's a blogger from Oakland, California, a longtime socialist, an activist, an author. Barry Shepherd, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you.
We're living in a time when the rich are getting rich and the poor are getting poorer. Half our population is poor or near poor, having been cast aside in the stagnation that has prevailed in the USA for the last 40 years. We don't have fascism in the USA, obviously. We wouldn't be broadcasting this interview if we did. But do you agree that we are in a pre-fascist moment, that what we see developing in the United States is a form of fascism that is from the same genus?
Not quite. But I would like to emphasize that we're living in a very dangerous moment. We can get into what is fascism after. First place, yes, you're correct about the 40 years of stagnation, but this was greatly accented by the financial collapse and Great Recession of 2008, which exacerbated the whole questions of stagnation and the very slow and recovery, so-called, which didn't help most of the population. And that's a background for the rise of Trump. During the 2016 election, you saw Trump saying America is in bad shape. You saw Sanders saying America is in bad shape. And 80% of the population saying America is in bad shape. And so Sanders and Trump both sort of tied into that sentiment that was in the country based on reality. But the Democratic Party establishment didn't. Hillary Clinton's answer to Trump's Make America Great Again was America is already great again. And 80% of the population knew that wasn't true. But in any case, the recent spat of violence in this past 2 weeks, the murder of two black people, an attempted attack on a whole congregation in Kentucky by a racist, and then followed by the exposure of all those package bombs being sent around the country, and then horrific attack of on Jewish people in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. And these things came one right after another. And those are important symptoms. And then I would like to add one more, because right after that, there was another similar attack by someone openly misogynist going into a yoga gym club and killing people and wounding people and then killing himself. But what came out of all that, as the authorities began to investigate what these people were like on the internet and et cetera, was that all of them were interconnected. These misogyny, racism, anti-Semitism, they all had aspects of that in each of them, which is a theme in the alt-right social media, which I didn't quite understand before this all happened and was exposed. That last year, when the Charlottesville alt-right rally occurred, and there was a murder there too, there was that Nazi march where they said, "You will not replace us," and that turned into, "Jews will not replace us." At first, I didn't understand quite what was that, but now it's clear what they meant, because a theme on the whole alt-right media is that white people are being attacked and they're in danger of being replaced by uppity women, by blacks, by immigrants, and extension from that, Latinos, Jews. Their litany goes on. The feeling of a section of white people that they are about to be destroyed, and they're fighting back.
Barry Shepherd, we have an example of fascism unfolding in Germany, and I wanted to ask you about that. Is fascism a working class movement? What classes in German society supported Hitler, and what classes in American society support Trump?
Well, first I just want to say that under Trump, fascist groups are growing, but they're small, and they fight amongst each other. They're unable to come together, and they certainly can't decide who's Führer and who's Il Duce, because each of them want head of each all of them want to be that. Now, the classes in that fascism appeals to in times of crisis were ruined middle class, especially, but also included workers at various times, but that was their base. I would say Trump's base is racists of all classes, white racists of all classes, and white nationalism. That's his real base, but it certainly includes a section of the middle class. Now in the United States is very different than in Germany. Back in the 20s, it was where a big section of the middle class were peasants. But small farmers have been almost wiped out in the United States. But there's a new middle class. We don't have to go into exactly what that is. So it's certainly not pro-working class. Trump isn't pro-working class, and neither, of course, was Hitler.
Barry, what was fascism like in Italy and Germany and Spain?
Fascism is an extreme system. absolute attempt to completely crush the working class. There was an important socialist woman in Germany, Clara Zetkin, who, after the first fascist rose in Italy, outlined during the early communist movement that arose out of the Russian Revolution. This is before it became Stalinism. She outlined these aspects. One is a severe economic crisis, and of course, Europe had been smashed by the ravages of the First World War. Two, the decline of its institutions, of the institutions of capitalism. We see that now, too. But another aspect of it was that there had been, before the rise, the thing that gave rise to fascism and why sections of the ruling class began to support them, was that working class in both Italy, say, and Germany, there was an attempt, there was a uprising, massive uprising. In Italy, there were occupations of factories, etc. In Germany, there was an actual near revolution. Both of those things could have led to a socialist revolution. It frightened the capitalist class a lot. And in that situation, but the working class failed to solve the economic crisis by taking power. And in that situation, there was a reaction to that failure, and that the fascists grew out of that. Third, was fascism has a mass character, and it's reflected in a mass organized party. And the what we've seen so far in these instances that we talked about in Pittsburgh, Kentucky, etc., are isolated people, although they're inspired by the ideology of the ultra right. We don't yet have a organized shock troops, partly because it's not yet necessary, because here we've never had a time when the working class almost took power, like in Italy and Germany and in Spain. But we don't even have we never had a mass socialist party or any threat like that. And that threat doesn't exist right now. So the ruling class doesn't have to turn to fascism. But between functioning bourgeois democracy with all its problems and fascism on another extreme, there are other in-between things. There's military dictatorship. There's what Marx analyzed as Bonapartism, which I think we have a lot of similarities today in. One, there is no threat from, really, there is no political, even expression, organized expression politically of the working class. But there's disarray in the capitalist parties. We've seen that. Now, it looks like Trump has suppressed some of that in the Republican Party and taken it over. But you just look at the Democrats. They're too. And there's no real solution to all the problems that we face. Coming out of Washington, that gives demagogy to Trump, saying, "We got to drain the swamp. See, they can't get things done, etc." So I think that's more like what we have now. And Trump always emphasized, right from the beginning of his campaign, first his ideology, racism, misogyny. That, right from the beginning, he pounded away on that. Two, we are in a bad situation, and I will solve it. I'm the man on the white horse who will come in and solve everything. Trust me. I think that's more like what we have right now.
Barry, can you talk about the relationship in Germany between fascism and big business, and then discuss how American big business looks to Trump?
Okay, the big business fell in behind the Nazis and supported them for the reasons I just outlined. They feared the working class, and what they wanted to do was smash the working class completely. And so they came behind the Nazis, and that helped put them in power. And, of course, both parties in the United States, the Democrats and Republicans, are capitalist parties supported by big business. Right now, there appears to be a political division. Important sections of the capitalist class that want to, and the big business, if you want to put it that way, who certainly support Trump. He couldn't have been elected if there wasn't a large section of the capitalist class behind him, who don't like some of his what he does. So there are divisions in the capitalist class over Trump, but he's so far is charging ahead. The danger, he hasn't yet taken full power, but he's done a lot of how he's used the executive to do a lot of things that, of course, big business totally agrees with. One thing was the big tax cuts for them, and the other is the deregulation and the use of the executive in the Environmental Protection Agency has now become the Environmental Destruction Agency. The Education Department has become, under Betsy DeVos, a department to smash public education and to privatize education. And there's a big drive for all those things the big business is totally behind, including those that have questions about Trump. So Trump is mainly by his control of the executive, with the exception of the tax cut, which came through the Congress, it's one thing after another of destruction of even these institutions that are supposed to be like the EPA. And all those things are pro-business, pro-business.
What would the USA look like if we were to have full-blown fascism?
It would be worse than Hitler's Germany. When fascism was on the rise in Germany, the great revolutionary Leon Trotsky, who was warning at the time that Hitler was extreme danger, but and the big working class parties at the time, the Social Democracy and the Communist Party, thought that there was no danger. They didn't see anything. Communist Party even said, after Hitler, our turn, which was ridiculous. After Hitler took power, they were crushed. But Trotsky looked at Italian fascism and warned that German fascism would be much, much worse because it was based on a much more higher level of capitalist industrial development than Italy. Look at today. Wouldn't Hitler have really liked to have what Snowden exposed about the NSA having the ability to monitor every American's phone and email and look at them if they want to? But every email and phone is automatically characterized by who's phoning what and things like that, and then the NSA can look at whatever they want. And there are many other ways in which American fascism would just be really much more horrible than the earlier forms of fascism.
Barry, let's talk about how to fight fascism. Fascism was not inevitable in Germany and could have been stopped. What should be done here? What positive developments do you see so far? And where do you think we should go from here? Like, for example, do we need our own political organization?
Yes, that's our big problem. We don't have, the working class doesn't have a mass socialist party. There are small socialist groups. We have to go towards that. And anything that goes in that direction, like if a labor party was formed, but we know that this labor bureaucracy is sick and sorry, but or if it can arise in some other way, or we can support, this is on the electoral front, but what's important also is mass mobilization. Now, we've seen that in response to Trump's racist attacks, and we've seen mass mobilizations against the alt-right when it does come out and demonstrate. And so the counter-demonstration is, but mass action, not individual actions, but mass action has proven to be in whenever these people raise their heads, if they're out-mobilized, their mobilizations get defeated. That's been true it was even true in Charlottesville. So I would say that we should look to mass mobilization. We should try work any way we can to make steps towards building an independent party independent of the Democrats and Republicans, which would go towards building a revolutionary socialist party. But I vote green. Because as a step forward to break, and we should look at any other things like that could be put forward. We need our own party.
Barry Shepherd, it's been a pleasure to be able to speak with you. Before we let you go, can you tell people how they can get a hold of you and what your blog site is?
Well, what I do is I write for some socialist newspapers. Every 2 weeks, articles, and send them out to anybody else who wants to get them. So anybody who wants to get them, just contact me at lundshep, LUNDSHEP, @att.net.
Great. Barry Shepherd, thank you very much for your thoughtful understanding of what we're facing. We really appreciated your being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.